When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul, Mission Control Deck, and most importantly, you are you. You are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. We're going on a journey today, fellow conspiracy realists. We are traveling to the far north. We're headed to Alaska, and we are looking for a town. It's a place you could easily miss unless you knew exactly where you were going and you knew exactly what you were looking for. This is a story of disaster. It's a story of death. And some would have you believe it is a story of monsters. Today's question, what happened to Portlock, Alaska? Before we begin, Matt, Noel, had you guys heard of this town before we started researching this?
I had not.
When I first came upon the stuff and, you know, shared it around with everybody, I had never heard of it. I'd never even heard of the peninsula that we're going to be talking about, this whole area. I know nothing. I just know it's frontier, it's Alaska, and I remember tiny bits of some of the history from, do you remember that Discovery show that came out a long time ago, Ben? It was the first fiction show that Discovery was making, and it was about Alaska.
Didn't our CEO, Connell Byrne, have something to do with that back in his Discovery days?
I think so. I remember looking up quite a bit of Alaska around that time and just learning about how, you know, you think the American West, as it was, you know, changing and as Westerners were moving out to the West, like how rough that was. But then realizing just how tough it was to exist in Alaska in, you know, in those earlier times, 1700s, 1800s, even the early 1900s.
What was the impetus to settle out there, Ben? Like, I mean, it seemed like so inhospitable. Was it about establishing trade, or were there resources to exploit, or a combination?
Yeah, both. And then later, it became an important and remains an important geopolitical barrier during the days of the Cold War. Alaska is very, very close to Russia, right? And so it behooves the U.S., at least in their calculations, to have something between their continent and Russia. This place is inhospitable. It is still dangerous. We'll probably allude to this a couple times in today's episode, but a few years back, Paul, Mission Control, and I traveled to Alaska, and I believe it was the first time for both of us. This was in the production of a show called Missing in Alaska, which also centers around a mystery in the far north. And it's very much on the edge of the wild in a way that many residents of the U.S. would be unfamiliar with and would perhaps find dangerous. But
Ben, where did you guys travel to when you made that?
Sure. Yeah, we were in Anchorage, Alaska. That's one of the easiest places to fly in. And we landed there. We were there for about 2 weeks, and we were gathering footage, gathering tape, gathering interviews. And Paul traveled to, I don't want to say too much without spoiling this story, but Paul and our host traveled to an incredibly remote location in Alaska on the open ocean and to an island searching for a plane crash. Those are the teasers. The show is available for free on your podcast platform of choice. Smash that like and subscribe button or whatever people say nowadays.
I guess my point is you guys have personal experience just being in Alaska, though it is a massive place, and specifically on an island. So like experiencing the water, like the shores and the water and how frigid and how dangerous that can be.
Yeah, so it may surprise people to know that even in the modern day, life in many parts of Alaska is at the mercy of nature and the passage of the seasons. So there are times where the ocean may simply be non-navigable in certain parts, right? And there are, for instance, when we were out working on this, we were racing against time because we had seasoned experts and veterans, pilots, captains who were saying, look, I've been doing this for decades. And if X, Y, and Z don't come together before, you know, this season hits, then you're going to have to wait another year. And that's just the reality of living with nature in a way that many people don't nowadays, because the majority of human beings live in urban areas. But this sets the stage. Just so you know, we're going to a very brutal place. Here are the facts. Nowadays, Portlock, or what Portlock used to be, the site where Portlock was located, is abandoned. This was once a pretty bustling hive of activity at the very edge of the frontier. It is located, as you said, Matt, on the very southern edge of something called the Kenai Peninsula.
That's right, and the closest town is a little bitty place about 16 miles to the north called Seldovia, which has a distinctly Nordic quality to the name. And just to give you an idea of exactly how remote this place is, Seldovia only has around 300 residents. There are no roads leading in or out, and it can only be reached by a small plane or boat. Because there's obviously an airport, so it would have to be one of those like planes that land on the water, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and the same really goes for Port Chatham or Portlock, what we're talking about here. And if you look at it on a map, you guys, it's at the edge of nowhere. There's ocean. There are a few islands right outside of where it is, like some tiny little islands, and there's, you know, some state parks around it and Port Graham, and then like you said, Seldovia, and that's it. It's incredible to imagine that people showed up there and started work to create any kind of living quarters or even a business.
Yeah, and the story already gets a little bit confusing because this place was known as Portlock.
And a lot of people outside of Alaska and outside of this region will refer to it as Portlock. But people who live in the area often use the phrase, often use the name Port Chatham interchangeably. That's because Portlock is located in Port Chatham Bay, but there's another nearby community called Port Chatham. Additionally, there are a ton of places named Port something or other in Alaska. Why? This sounds a little weird at first. Here's why. It is important to remember modern exploration of the area, by which we mean after Native people have been living there for thousands of years. Modern exploration of the area depended heavily on maritime transportation of resources and people. There were no planes, there wasn't any air travel, and the brutal realities of overland crossing, even now, with modern roads and the internal combustion engine, even now it's still difficult. But back then, you would be naturally limited to how much you could take by, like, traveling by foot or traveling by sled, what have you. And, you know, also you had to have honest conversations with your fellow travelers, like, how much are we willing to risk for this? You know, is it worth it just to wait a year for a boat instead of, you know, just trying to get out there and hope we make it back? This is a crazy time. It's something that a lot of people might find hard to understand, but it was reality for many, many people for decades and decades and decades. And it's the town itself is named after a guy named Nathaniel Portlock. He's a sea captain, maritime fur trader. He was active in the area in the late 1700s, specifically 1786. They took that's like the claim to fame, if you want to call it that. And this originally started out as purely a business town. It was a salmon cannery. Mm-hmm.
And it later led to some other business operations, some kind of more industrial manufacturing. There was a chromite mining operation, and they named the site Chrome, which I'm assuming, which is also what the Google browser is named after. Probably not. But this led to it really being a place of note enough that a post office was established in Portlock in 1921, but it would still be some time, 20 plus years, in fact, well, a little less than 20 years before it appeared on the U.S. Census, when it was still listed as an unincorporated village with a population of 31, which, as we know, is not quite accurate. But most of the town's history consisted of a population that was largely made up of Russian expats and Aleuts, which would be the indigenous kind of tribal folk of that area, of that region.
And there's a really interesting history in this entire area of these Russian Aleut schools. It's not necessarily stuff they don't want you to know, at least to my mind right now, but fascinating history. Recommend you look into that if you have some time for yourself.
Yeah, I believe there was a territorial school in the area at the time. And in that population makes sense because the Aleut were already there, as were the other indigenous people, and again, had been there for a very, very, very long time. And then Russian travelers, Russian explorers, were the closest other people who could get there. So it makes sense that they would show up first. If we were all to travel there now, you listening today and the stuff they don't want you to know, gang, we would see little more than ruins. There's an old mining tunnel and some rusted cannery equipment, the sad skeletal remains of houses. It's all being slowly eaten away by nature. But there's a legend about this town, and it's a place some locals don't like to visit. You see, around 1949, people started leaving in droves, en masse. By 1950, that post office Noel mentioned had closed, and this effectively brought an end to Portlock, Alaska. So, what happened? Here's where it gets crazy.
Oh, we're already here.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Oh, no.
So, for many people in the area, Portlock's mysterious depopulation is not just a sad story of gentrification or failing business. It's the story of a monster. And what we'd like to do with you now, folks, is share the story as it's generally presented. So gather around with us in your mental campfire. Get a little closer to the flame, not just for the heat, but for the light, because there's darkness all around us. A few years after the establishment of this salmon cannery, people began disappearing.
And you can read about this story if you want to see the full thing in places like Alaska Magazine and in Today's Alaska, a couple other places. So if you want to find your own sources, go ahead and head out there and you'll read very much the same stories that we're about to tell you here.
And then later on, we'll also tell you the primary source that they're all based on.
Exactly. But here, let's tell the story, as you said, Ben. There are several people that met untimely deaths out in Portlock, at least according to the stories.
Or disappearances.
Or disappearances. Sometimes mangled bodies. Who knows? But there's a person named Andrew Kamluck who is said to have gone out logging in 1931. And he was discovered dead from a blow to his head. And there was some logging equipment found near him that may or may not have been part of his death.
Sure. I mean, there's plenty of, you know, accidents that can befall you in situations like that where you're working with heavy machinery or heavy equipment, or even just, you know, having to climb and maybe take a fall. So there's certainly other explanations. But then we get into Tom Larson. Tom Larson went out to also chop wood, maybe less of an industrial thing, more of just like, you know, splitting logs. And he claims to have seen something, quote, large and hairy on the beach. So he went back to his house and he got his rifle and he found this creature to still be kind of lurking around the area when he got back. And they got into a bit of a staring competition. And Larson did not shoot at the time. And
according to some of those stories, they all posit he doesn't know why he didn't pull the trigger.
Right. Because a lot of that is copy pasted, to be candid. And the one thing that maybe the more skeptical in the crowd would note already at this point is the following. And I'm fine to say it. I know it's cold, but it's true. People are very good at dying. It's the one thing every person successfully does at some point. So we have to endeavor to stick to what we know. There's a lot of speculation surrounding Kamluck, and there are a lot of speculation surrounding these other incidents, like hunters tracking a moose who found that something else appeared to be tracking the same creature, something that left 18-inch human-like or primate-like footprints. Side note, if you have been tracking stuff through snowy weather, you know that depending on the climate at the time and how much time has passed, those footprints can erode and look larger than they originally were. And either way, these hunters came across a flattened spot in the brush, and that's where they believe this large animal, this, wait for it, big-footed animal, didn't just kill a moose, but was large enough and powerful enough to pick the carcass up and carry it away. If you have ever seen a moose, that is terrifying.
It is. And I mean, this is the kind of thing that is the stuff of legend. So you're going to get different accounts of this and people adding their own details. But I've certainly heard versions of the story where it looked like some sort of, you know, melee had taken place between these animals or whatever the other thing was. And that there were signs of blood even in the snow and on the brush.
Yes. And then there's one little other thing that gets added sometimes that they followed the footprints until they vanished. They began to vanish into the fog as they went up a mountain.
And that's why, according to legend, locals will still tell you to avoid the area on a foggy day. There's also stories of people like a gold miner from nearby Port Graham. It's a different port. It's not Port Chatham. It's Port Graham, who one day went off to the mines or went off to look for gold and never returned. You'll also hear, again, numerous reports of mutilated bodies being found as cannery employees disappeared into the hills and the wilderness, only to wash up later in nearby streams. In many of these cases, as you can probably already ascertain, right, the events have been embellished online or by fringe researchers who often are putting a good story over solid facts. Sometimes they will do what we sometimes call the ancient aliens thing. And this is where they'll relay the stuff they've read from whatever source they found. And almost all of it ultimately comes from, as we'll see, a really small collection of sources. And then they'll pose their own embellishments, not as statements, but in a little bit more weaselly way, as questions. It's like, so if you see an episode of Ancient Aliens, and they'll say something like, the stonework and the masonry of Machu Picchu remains unexplainable by modern standards. What if they had help? What if there was some other civilization at play? Where did they come from? Could it be related to the stories of Atlantis or other ancient, incredibly advanced civilizations? Could it be aliens? Cut to commercial.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel.
Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
So tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
And we're back. We really did it. We did the move.
Well, well done. Commercial after that was so fresh and so clean, Ben.
Already, right, for those of us who are fascinated by cryptids or by the concept of cryptids, this feels like it has all the ingredients of a lurid, perfect monster story. And that's why, if you, like us, started reading about Portlock on various internet forums today or in books about Sasquatch or Bigfoot, you'll see a lot of people claim, hey, something like Bigfoot was active in this area, was responsible for these attacks. But it's tough because, you know, when you go back to primary sources, aside from the one witness who survived, Larson, it doesn't seem like a lot of other people made it to the other side of these encounters. And that would seem oddly aggressive for Sasquatch, which is, you know, basically the world's reigning hide-and-seek champion, if it exists. I mean, it's famously reclusive, like a lot of other large fauna. You know, bears don't wake up excited to come see you. they don't know why you're around. And it's irritating and confusing and frightening to them. And we can assume the same could be said of a lot of other large animals, except for, you know, some of the big cats and hippos and crocodiles. Those creatures will actively hunt you.
I just had an image just being hunted by the alligators specifically. Okay. Whew. Push that out of my mind.
Or sorry, Nile crocodiles will actively stalk people.
Oh, okay. I was going to say.
They don't care. They do not care. But it's, I mean, it's interesting because I forgot to mention this. Like, I thought I had never heard of Portlock, but I believe I have heard a fictionalized version of it. Fictionalized in that it doesn't purport to be true. It's a horror story called The Men from Portlock, which is by an excellent writer named Laird Barron. If you enjoy horror, then do check out his short stories and, you know, have a source of light nearby if you're easily spooked.
Do we know roughly when that was published or like the era?
Huh. You know, I'd have to go back and check, Matt.
Okay.
Yeah, it couldn't have been too long ago. I believe it was in maybe this anthology that comes out every year called Best Horror of the Year. That might be it. Edited by someone named Ellen Datlow.
But so we're pretty confident it came out after, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so. Laird Barron is alive. He was not writing this in 1949 or anything like that. So, which will make sense when you see how the legend builds. So you'll see books with titles like Abandoned, The History and Horror of Port Chatham, Alaska, and they lean into this idea that a monster attacked the town and ultimately drove everyone out, but they don't dig into a lot of the context or details there. And, you know, that's not a ding on the book. That's the choice these authors made. And I believe in the case of Abandoned, there's also a video, right? There's a video piece of people hunting or attempting to find something like Bigfoot in the area.
Oh, there's a whole special you can find titled In Search of the Port Chatham Hairy Man.
That's the one, yeah.
Is that with Leonard Nimoy?
Nope, it's not In Search of,
okay.
It's just called that.
I misunderstood. I was going to be like, he's not that hairy.
No. This one was directed by Josiah Martin and written by Larry Baxter. And it features, what's his name? Stephen T. Major, person you may or may not recognize.
I may not.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Larry Beans Baxter. That's the people call him Beans. That's true. I was reading about him, but like, here's the question, and we'll get into monsters in just a second. But for now, it's important to remember that a lot of people immediately shut down when they hear this sort of explanation. For many people listening to the show today, the concept of a violent human-like creature, a Bigfoot, fighting back against mankind's encroachment, or would it be gentrification at that point? I don't know. Unclear. I guess it depends on how close those are to human. It's a non-starter, right? People are saying these things don't exist, therefore they could not be a reasonable explanation. But either way, wherever you find yourself on the skepticism scale, the fact of the matter is that Portlock, Alaska is abandoned. And for one reason or another, the town shut down completely, which means that something had to happen. And if you dig into the stories about the town's demise, you see that you can trace the sources. Many of the lurid tales of the disappearances and the purported deaths come from a single author, primarily an article written by Naomi Clauda in 2009 for the Homer Tribune. And Brian Dunning over at Skeptoid, which of course you can tell by the title, is a source with an angle. Dunning points out that Clauda's work itself hinges on two sources. And one of those is an article that she also wrote way back in 1973 for a different outfit, the Anchorage Daily News. So she's taking some of that information from the 70s and carrying it on to this 2009 article, which you can read in full online. And I believe you can find the text of the full 1973 article in in the archive at an Alaskan library. I can't remember which one.
I'll just tell you the easiest way to find the article that was later written based off that 1973 one. I had to go to the Wayback Machine on archive.org, and I searched for Homer Tribune and her name, Naomi Clowda, and you can find it. The article is titled Port Chatham Left to Spirits, and that's spelled C-H-A-T-H-A-M.
Yep, hole in one. So the second source is a little more interesting, I think, because it's closer to the actual events. A couple of people who grew up in Portlock survived, and they moved with their families to Port Graham, and they were living in Port Graham at the time that they were interviewed by Clowda, and they were interviewed through a translator. These interviewees are the inspiration for Clowda's speculation on the cryptid angle. It's also fair to assume that while they might be the only people interviewed, they were sharing a belief that was not uncommon for folks at the time, and possibly, as has been reported, in the modern day. Let's focus on one of the interviewees, Melania Helen Kell. She talked about those now typical tales of disappearance and death. This was regional folklore by this point, and it's something that Clowda was well aware of, but Kell was able to do something pretty significant. She added specific details. She was the person who would say, oh, you know, that logger, his name was, for instance, Andrew Kamlick or something like that. And when she was talking about this stuff, she and some other people are the ones who introduced the idea of supernatural involvement, of a local supernatural entity, something called the Nantinook, N-A-N-T-I-I-N-A-Q.
It's a tricky
Nantinook,
one. It's a mouthful.
To make it feel a little more like a spelling
name. Exactly. And then, you know, this is something that would have been from the lore of this indigenous people. I mean, so it's interesting to have that detail. And not only is this a cryptid type Bigfoot creature that, you know, has corporeal personification, I guess, in this, you know, potentially violent animal, for lack of a better term, it's meant to also be sort of a spiritual deity, like a demon of some sort, like some kind of malevolent force. And they believed, according to Kell, that this was some kind of curse that was escalating, and it was just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And these patterns they were seeing were just going to continue until something was done about it, or until they just, you know, said, hey, we're out of here.
Yeah. So she said, Kell says that this creature was the reason her parents said they had to leave town. They said, look, there's an escalating pattern of attacks. Honey, that's why we're leaving. But we're not going far. We're just going over to the next port town.
And it really isn't that far from where they were living. So it's weird to think that, you know, we're under attack here in this very specific place. But if we just travel a little bit over the land or around, you know, from this port just around to this other port, we'll be fine. It's weird to imagine that. So in my mind, when I think about it, I think of a territorial animal that you know, lives in a very specific place. It's not like there are a bunch of these Nantinooks, you know, living all around the area the way, you know, I guess, I don't know why I'm thinking squirrel populations, but like wolves or anything you may find out there in the wilderness of Alaska. It's more of a, like a family or a single thing that lives in one spot.
Right. Yeah, it's an important point because it's supposed to, if we're talking about something that's a supernatural entity, then it is completely possible for it to be very long lived or perhaps immortal, right? And it is possible for it to be a single thing. So that's why you don't see a lot of questions about what would the active range of this creature be? What would its scat look like? Where would it nest? How would it reproduce? Anyhow, this sounds like big news. Everybody in town left because there's a monster that is killing people and mutilating them. If these attacks were happening multiple times over a period of years, and they were indeed escalating, culminating in this exodus from 1949 to 1950 or so, multiple papers of the day would have probably mentioned it, right? Probably. That would have been a way to sell papers.
One would think. I mean, if it bleeds, it leads. And there was blood all over the snow of Portlock, right? I don't know if we mentioned this, but these injuries, I mean, at least according to many of these primary sources, which can get diluted in the retelling, you know, of this tale, these injuries weren't typical injuries that you'd see, you know, done by like a bear attack or a wolverine attack or something. These were much more grisly and like, you know, like essentially being almost mutilated and torn limb from limb in some kind of borderline ritualistic way.
At least that's what people in the modern day are saying, right? The thing is, to the point about the idea that multiple papers would be highly incentivized to write about this, not even just for money. Let's not be entirely cynical about this. Papers were a way to warn people and help them. So there would be an ethical journalistic responsibility, arguably, to spread word of this. But the thing is, they don't. The Library of Congress has hundreds of thousands of archived records from newspapers in Alaska dating all the way back to the late 1700s, to the time of Nathaniel Portlock himself. And some of these stories do actually mention this tiny town of Portlock. And when they mention this tiny town of Portlock, they talk about the business there, which is why the town existed. They talk about stuff like fishing and the cannery and maybe a little bit about mining chromite. They do not mention anything about a rash of unexplained deaths, disappearances, and mutilations. The one story.
It's because they don't want to scare people away from the cannery, right? Dude, the salmon's still there. They need workers.
I mean, that's not right. That's not far off from what could possibly be the case. I mean, they depended on this for their very existence and sustenance. And they had this industry that if no one will work, the industry fizzles. And it already was a very, very small, you know, industry to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good point. And a counterpoint to that would be that the more powerful newspapers of the time would not have been affected by that town getting bad press. They would have benefited from it. So, but either way, the fact is, it didn't get reported. Was it a cover-up? Was it because in their mind there was nothing to report? We'll leave the ultimate answer to you, folks, as always. But what we did find is that there was a story about crime. There's one hilarious story about crime, and it's about the postmaster. Because remember, we said the post office started in 1921, which really put a stamp of legitimacy on the town. The guy at the time, the postmaster, George Hank, was arrested by G-Men. 1924, got caught with a gallon of moonshine. No Sasquatch was believed to be involved.
Yeah, but maybe George and some other folks were dealing in some serious moonshine production out there somewhere, and it was organized, and well, you could even call them organized criminals. Wait a second. No, I'm just joking. That's my speculation and like coming up with ideas because I have this one fact. Just an example.
And disappearances did get reported. There was one reported in 1920. And then later, before then, there was a report of a boat being found in 1917. And the boat that washed ashore in Portlock was the same kind of boat that these two hunters had set off on from Seward, Alaska, before they disappeared. You know, it's kind of like saying Paul and Noel leave on a road trip to the Southwest, and they were leaving in a Ford Mustang, and then later in Texas, someone found a Ford Mustang.
And you guys disappeared.
Yeah, yeah.
Checks out. So that sounds like something we would do.
So it doesn't explain, you know what I mean? It doesn't directly link anybody. So that's the reporting you can find from the day that seems to be largely like the fact-based documentation of that time. That doesn't mean these things didn't happen, but it does definitely mean the people that were supposed to be reporting on these for some reason did not.
Yeah, no, I agree. It is weird that there's nothing written there. And we can't stress that enough. It is weird. And if there was something really going on, that is weird. I want to talk specifically about this creature, this Nantinuk, whatever or Nantanak, whatever that thing is, because some of the attacks, some of the lore that's been generated around this thing doesn't feel so much like a Bigfoot to me. It feels more like stuff I've read about a different legendary creature, a Wendigo. And I know there's some similarities here, but Wendigo is a very different creature. I just wonder if we found anything that shows Bigfoot maybe wasn't the original culprit or the original legendary creature that existed.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. So let's go back to the monsters. What exactly is a Nantanok? It is originally not a Bigfoot. It comes from a dialect that is extant on the Kenai Peninsula, and the languages here are rich and diverse. There are a ton of different languages. This word itself, Nantanok, seems to be a loan word from another language. So the original word would be something like Nantaina, which means literally those who steal people.
Oh.
And there's not a connection to cannibalism, right? The way there is often with the Wendigo. This thing was more like a boogeyman, more like a thing you would tell your kids about to make sure they didn't go outside.
Like a Babadook kind of situation.
It reminds me of maybe tales of witches in, you know, the frontiers of the United States as it's being settled in the mainland, where the tales of witches were that they will steal you away, basically, if you're a child. At least some of those tales were that.
Yeah, and a lot of that's an oral tradition of getting kids to behave, right?
Well, and just beware of all the things that can harm you if you're a small child, especially predators and real animals.
Yeah, whether you're talking about like El Coco or the Sacman or the Aswang or whatever, the various features of these creatures or entities may differ, but ultimately the gist is there's something bad out there in the dark. Stay inside and don't wander away. Even if it's daytime, if I can't keep an eye on you, you're doing something bad, kid, and there will be consequences.
Yeah, and I have to chop all that wood so we don't freeze later this year. So yes. I can't just look at you the whole time.
So yeah, this thing the description of it did not originally fit what we understand to be the description of Bigfoot. But over the decades since this incident, various authors have conflated the two concepts. So now people will understandably, but incorrectly assume Nantanok is another word for Sasquatch, which it is not. And the question of whether these authors made this conflation as an honest error or whether they did it as a purposeful embellishment is a little tougher to determine. You'd have to go to each person and figure it out.
And I know this. I know that Sasquatch, you know, myths often associate them having some sort of interdimensional powers where they can, you know, move very quickly or do various things that you might ascribe to a supernatural being or deity. And to me, the Nantanok just takes that a step further. Like, it's almost like a spiritual being first and then like an embodiment of this creature second, which is, I see where you're going with the Wendigo thing, Matt, because that's sort of very similar to that, where it's a malevolent spirit that is out to cause havoc and wreck the lives of those in its wake, you know?
Yeah. And so we see this transformation, and this is common in folklore, right? Myths commingle and they speak with one another. So, like, the issue, though, is Kel and other locals at the times of interviews did seem adamant, certain, that at least in their memory, this monster, this entity, was the reason the grown-ups of the time gave for leaving Port Luck, Alaska. And as any parents know, sometimes the stories you tell your children aren't the hard facts of a given situation, right? You kind of explain it through what feels like the most efficient, comfortable frame of reference for that young mind. But there are some other details I found regarding the story of Kel's interview. So I mentioned earlier that there was a translator for this interview. believe that translator's name is Sally Ash. And Sally was able to speak multiple languages. So she was, and she was a cousin of Kel's. She said that, according to the true belief system of the people, the Nontinook is not like a Sasquatch. It's more of a, as we've described, a supernatural being. And the idea was that they were reclusive. They didn't really want to hang out with people. They had been sighted, but they were not trying to run up on you, essentially. And then for this interview for the Homer Tribune, the one that, you know, blew up the story, it seemed that Sally Ash wants to clear the air about this controversy. And there's a great article about this in the Anchorage Press. She said that she said that this story was kind of manufactured, or at the very least purposely embellished by Kel, because Kel was getting so tired of people always asking her whether the story was true. So she spun a tale around a campfire. And Sally says that my sisters, my cousins, and I all were there while this was happening, and we didn't want her to get mad at us, so we didn't want to be disrespectful to her, but later we would all have a laugh about this. So even this interview gets called into question later. Still, given that we know something definitely happened, and given that the stories seem, at least some of the stories, hopelessly exaggerated, unprovable, or muddled together, already becoming a piece of folklore, it's fair to say there's a missing piece of the puzzle here. What could it be? At this point, unless we all go camping in Portlock, we'll have to make our best guess.
But for now, let's get our sleeping bags just in our rooms here and take a quick nap while we listen to these ads.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel.
Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
So tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
And we've returned. Let's search for some answers. Okay, first, make no mistake. As we said at the top, Alaska was and is a dangerous place. Even now, even if you were in the capital, you can look out on the horizon and you will have a palpable sense of being at the edge of the frontier. Even though Alaska is sparsely populated, I pulled some statistics that might be interesting. It has the highest rate of missing persons in the nation. California has the highest number of absolute missing persons, but Alaska has the highest rate of missing persons. For every 10,000 people, 41.8 will become missing persons.
Oh boy. We need to get our missing 411 guy over here again. Serious.
David Pilates.
Yeah, this is a lot of missing people. Okay, that's pretty disturbing. And we talked about it before. It's about the environment itself, right? It's about when you need something, you may not be able to get it, like a man-made tool or a man-made vehicle or something like that. You may not be able to use a vehicle to travel around.
And even in, you know, with the scant kind of infrastructure that they would have had in this sort of settlement type situation, you know, back before there was modern technology and stuff, that certainly could make living in Alaska at least a little more tolerable and less utterly terrifying and dangerous. I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility that this number of disappearances might have happened just organically from like going out into the wilds and taking a fall, you know, or because a lot of it, I believe a lot of these bodies were discovered in a lagoon after washing down from various rivers that were like higher up in elevation. So, I mean, you know, again, the mangling and all of that, we don't have firsthand accounts or images of this. So this is a lot of this is hearsay or possibly like a way to explain why are so many people dying. But you really could just explain it by saying, yeah, it's because it's a harsh environment that is a very scary place to live. And there's many, many, many ways to die. Like you said, Ben, that's something that human beings are great at doing.
From way back when the first humans were there to right now, the cold is one of the biggest things you got to worry about. And if you are not fully prepared and experienced to go through cold weather like that, especially if you're on foot, then it's over. And you're just lost for a while until your body shows up.
Mm-hmm. And when you are in a place without infrastructure, support, easy access to medical care, something as small as a broken ankle can spell the end of your story. You have to be very careful. So just imagine how much more common this is back in the day. There's no GPS. There's no satellite communication. There's someone who's expecting you in a month or so. So the stakes are high. And secondly, even now, towns across North America, across Canada, the U.S., Mexico, and towns across the world only exist when it makes sense for people to live there. So odds are, if you are listening in the U.S. right now, you are maybe a day or two, maybe 3 days away by car from an abandoned site near you. And many ghost towns become depopulated when they're no longer relevant on trade routes or when the industries they depended on were no longer relevant to the larger economy. This is why you see towns across the states that were abandoned when new railroad lines bypassed them, right? And now the horse and carriage trade that they depended on is all going by rail miles and miles north or miles and miles south or west or what have you. This is also why when you see a new stretch of interstate passing through a different town, people from the town that was no longer convenient by the interstate would tend to move. There would be brain drain. There would be population drain. And with this in mind, it's quite possible that the real murderer of Portlock, Alaska, may have been something as simple and as ruthless as progress.
Ah, that dastardly progress. I can see this making sense, especially when you consider what really did happen in the 1940s, because we're talking about like immediately post-World War II, right, when the mass exodus occurred or when the last people left Portlock. And there's a little coincidence here, and or just something that happened around the same time. Alaska Route 1, Zay Highway, was built during the 1940s, and it legitimately fundamentally changed the transportation routes, the game, the whole game of transportation.
Yeah, very, very much so, because there's, like we mentioned, there's so many ports in that area, port something or others, right? That's because overland travel, when you're talking about moving weight, it was dangerous, it was risky, and it was at times unreliable. So now you have a way to most more safely transport goods in bulk over land. This means you don't need as many ships. This means also you don't need as many ports. And if you live in a town that, like Portlock, is not accessible from this new roadway from Alaska Route 1, then things are starting to look economically grim, because you've got, so if you look at the map of the peninsula, like Matt said at the top, what you can see is that Portlock is at the southern tip, kind of trending a little bit toward the western side. And if you look at the way that Alaska Route 1 is built, it's on the other side of that peninsula.
Yeah,
it's on the opposite side.
And Port Graham is on the other side of that peninsula, where there are stories of people moving directly from Portlock to Graham.
Right. So in this way, people of Portlock were luckier than some other towns, because they could move and they didn't have to move too far away. When they moved, they were still close enough to maintain their lifestyles, their family connections, right? Their communities, their friends. They were able to relocate their businesses. And in fact, there's pretty solid argument to be made that their businesses would have thrived because of their access to this new trade route through Route 1. So it's possible then that people like Keel's parents just told her a story they thought a kid would understand, instead of walking her through the ins and outs of local economics. Unfortunately, it looks like the very same person who translated that story is telling us that it was little more than a tall tale or a prank. Unfortunately, we'll never know, as the parents themselves were not interviewed.
It's hard with this kind of stuff because so much of it is wrapped up in superstition and wrapped up in this very, very harsh existence and this kind of, you know, combination of these indigenous tales and folks that are, you know, very superstitious. So you get these versions of the story that really lean into the, oh, but the mutilations were made by some hellfire creature that couldn't possibly walk the earth, you know, that we know of, and really muddies the waters. But there is the idea that Portlock, simply because, again, of the nature of the size of it and the remoteness of it, that it just became less economically viable. And that's something that certainly could be leaned into by the skeptical crowd. But it still is a place that locals tend to avoid. There are other superstitious tales wrapped up in this. I wasn't able to find a direct primary source, but there are, you know, people who describe the area as haunted and as of seeing apparitions and other kind of spooky stuff, not just, you know, a limb from limb tearing monster. So you can explain this stuff away all you want, but superstitious people remain superstitious, especially if they're part of generations of this kind of superstitious storytelling.
Yeah. People in Seldovia, Port Graham, another place called Nanwalek also you'll find people there saying that the area is haunted. But with that, you know, you could say that about a lot of places, honestly. You can go to almost any region in the world and you'll see a lot of people who say, this part of, I don't even know if I believe in ghosts, but that abandoned asylum,
right?
not gonna catch me there.
A million percent.
Fully. Yeah. Fully haunted. But you know, and they always say it's of the people who died in these mysterious ways, they're the ones that actually haunt it. Not the spirit itself or the creature.
Right. And in this, and in that case, you have to ask how much of that has been generated purposely by mass media, you know, but the local aspects, the regional folklore is true. And there are people possibly listening with us to the show today who have personally encountered these tales. We would love to hear from you. It's also possible that people, of course, most people don't want to seem credulous or silly or superstitious. So these beliefs or this discomfort might be something they keep largely to themselves, to their close friends or their confidants. You know, it's not something that you start a blog about. And at the same time, it's possible that various cryptozoologists and Bigfoot hunters exploring the area are, whether consciously or unconsciously, prioritizing beliefs that support their own hope. The hope that something exists out there on the edge of civilization, something both powerful and territorial, more than capable of pushing humanity back from the edges of the map. If there were something like this, Alaska is not a bad candidate as a place for it to call home. I mean, again, if you've seen a moose up close.
Well, yes, yeah.
Just a moose.
Yeah. And you just go, pick it up. And take it with you back up a mountain. But I'm not going to discount the possibility that perhaps something exists out there in the peaks, in the valleys, in the woods, maybe in a cave system. Something might be out there. I'm not going to say it does. I'm going to say it likely doesn't exist. But I'm one of those people, Ben, I think you might be too, that hopes something is out there.
Yeah.
Just don't like poke it, you know, if it walks up on you, because it could.
I want to poke it. Let's go.
No, I think that's a really bad idea, Matt.
Bring it on, Bigfoot.
Like those arms? You like those arms?
No.
Yeah, okay, because it will probably rip them from your bod.
I just want to make friends and have tea.
You got to have arms to have tea, Matt.
I just want to see as much as possible. You know what I mean? Before the last sun sets or the last star goes out or however you want to wax poetic about the very end of things.
The brief candle and all that, right?
Yeah, et cetera, et cetera. Burn bright, friends. So with this in mind, we pass the torch to you. Let us know if you have ever been fortunate enough to explore Portlock, Alaska for yourself. Let us know what you saw. Let us know what other stories you have heard, whether you think they have some sand, and it doesn't have to be in Alaska. Every remote place has some sort of cryptid story, whether you're talking about the Mongolian death worm, whether you're talking about the abominable snowman or the Yeti. There are a wealth of stories, some that are treated just like tall tales, some that are treated as realistically as you would treat another wild animal and the threat it poses in the wild. We can't wait to hear from you. We try to make it easy to find us online, and we'll also, the places we're about to tell you about online are also where you can find pictures if we ever make it to Portlock, Alaska, and more importantly, make it back.
That's right. You can find us on the usual internet places of note. We are Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram.
Yes, and we have a phone number. You can call it. It's 1-833-STDWYTK. You can leave a voicemail. Oh yeah, for 3 minutes, up to 3 minutes. And when you do call in, please give yourself a cool nickname, whatever you'd like to be called. Leave your message. And if you got anything personal to say to us or the super producers that work with us, say it right at the end. That's perfect. Just do it just like that. If 3 minutes is not enough time to say everything you want to say, we highly recommend you instead send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro. Pairs well with anything. Pro. Probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health-Aid Kombucha today.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.